Natalie told her Aunt Nat that she was staying with a dear friend of mine, a Boston girl, who is married and living out here. Carol well understood the camaraderie and intimacies developed during outback expeditions, having herself fallen in love with and married her cowboy guide after knowing him for just 6 months. And as Carol may have done several months before, Natalie defended her choice for a husband to friends and family back east. "Of course my family would have liked me to marry a rich banker or some version of the well-to-do and tired businessman, but I could never have been really happy with anyone but an artist of some kind, because my whole makeup demands that kind of understanding." Natalie penned similar letters to friends, including her patrons, Peabody, Mason, and Frizzell, each of whom was surprised but ultimately supportive. But they were worried, too, worried that Natalie would not return and complete her work on Negro folk songs, although she assured everyone that with Paul by her side, she would return to the South and resume her study. The Robert Henrys returned to Santa Fe in June 1917 and moved into the Safford House on 601 Palace Avenue. Planning to remain in Santa Fe until the art museum opened in late November, Henry set up a studio in the adobe dwelling. He wrote Alice that Santa Fe was more beautiful and delightful than ever. During his second summer in Santa Fe, Henry immersed himself in the domestic and artistic life of the small town at the foot of the Sangre de Cristos. His home was a pleasant walk from the old plaza and the palace of the governors. Henry shared the house and yard with his wife and her sister, their friend Lucy, also a painter, Hilda the cook, Flossie the feline, Patsy the canine, four burros, whose names I do not know, plus a chorus of bees, wasps, bumblebees, lizards, children of the earth, Jerusalem crickets, horned toads, and etc., etc. The new art museum was close to completion, and the anticipation and planning for its grand opening gave Santa Feans a happy distraction from the distressing news of the war. But like other towns across America, Santa Fe's social agenda was dictated by the organizations and activities involved with the war effort. Henry described to Alice the Cowboy Ball, a benefit for the Navy boys, held at the Armory, for which we, the art colony, made posters that were awarded to the best costumes. "It was a success," Henry wrote, "and the costumes make a good spectacle, notwithstanding my own opinion that having a cowboy costume party in cowboy country is like taking coals to Colgate." Henry's studio on Palace Avenue was within walking distance, as was most everything in Santa Fe, of the rustic three-room adobe Paul Berlin rented on the hillside corner of Buena Vista and Old Santa Fe Trail. The Henrys, like most people in town, knew Berlin and Natalie Curtis were engaged. By 1917, Natalie and Berlin may have been cohabitating in the little house on Buena Vista. There was no date set yet for the wedding, but Natalie and Berlin's relationship was the talk and toast of the town. Henry wrote Alice in mid-June, "Yes, there are nuptials in the air at Santa Fe. It's no secret, and both Bride and Berlin are radiantly transformed. May they be blessed with much happiness and not a large family." The marriage of Natalie Curtis and Paul Berlin took place at high noon in the federal courthouse a few blocks north of the Santa Fe Plaza on July 25, 1917. It was a quiet and simple affair conducted by Supreme Court Justice Clarence J. Roberts. Carol and Roy Faffel and a friend from San Diego, Alice E. Chafee, witnessed the brief ceremony. Although the marriage license had been obtained 5 days before, Alice Klauber did not or could not make it to Santa Fe for the wedding. After the ceremony, the wedding party joined friends at one of the restaurants on the plaza for a celebration that lasted into the evening and included nearly everyone in Santa Fe's expat community of artists, archaeologists, tour guides, politicians, physicians, and shopkeepers. Henry wrote Alice a comprehensive description of Natalie's wedding, and in his missive about the happy day, he took the opportunity to express his feelings about desert khaki. "Miss Curtis, Mrs. Berlin, looked fine. I hardly knew her out of khaki, however that is spelled, and I should advise all women never to wear khaki except when roughing it very roughly. And even then, I see no reason to have to wear such a colorless color. They looked happy, and I hope they will make a great go of it. Henry told Alice that the Berlin's honeymoon was in the Penitentes country, a nickname for Rio Arriba County and the region of northern New Mexico where the mysterious and once forbidden Catholic folk religion, Los Penitentes, the penitent ones, had thrived in rural communities since the late 1700s. In 1917, the Hispanic villages of the Rio Grande near Española, north along the Chama River, and throughout the mountains near Taos, still had active, albeit clandestine, penitentes organizations that met regularly in their local moradas, meeting places. During his years in the Forest Service, Roy Pfaffel had worked with and earned the trust of dozens of local ranchers, many of whom were penitente hermanos, brothers. With friends active in the village moradas, Roy knew more than most Anglos about the penitentes. The Pfaffels' Oñate Hotel was likely where the Berlins spent at least part of their penitentes country honeymoon. They may have gone with Roy and Carol by auto, if Paul was hoping to paint, or by horseback to visit the moradas in Alcalde on the Rio Grande, or in villages like Abiquiu on the Chama River. Berlin's painting, titled Penitentes Santuario, dated before 1918, may have been painted during the August honeymoon. A Southwestern-style wedding announcement designed by Natalie and Paul, celebrating the iconic mountains, mesas and pueblos, that were the beloved landscape of their new life, was sent out to friends and colleagues on both coasts by early August. Charles Lummis, although working as an advisor on the new museum and frequently seen in Santa Fe and New Mexico, a place he referred to as my own country, was not in town for Natalie's wedding, nor was he aware of her romance with Berlin. Upon receiving the wedding announcement, Lummis wrote, "Dear Natalie, Curtis Plus, as the Spanish say, when least you expect it, up jumps the jackrabbit. I had no prevision of any such news as I have just received, but I am surely glad now, as always, of any good fortune or happiness that comes to you." Lummis hoped Natalie and Paul celebrating would get over as far into the wilderness as his home near Los Angeles, so that we shall have the pleasure of having you under our roof. In late summer, Mimsy sent out her own announcement of Natalie's Santa Fe wedding. Her mailing list included more than 1,000 names, and it included Paul Berlin's friends and acquaintances. Mimsy wrote George that Paul's list included many Goldbergs, Freibergs, not in the social register. As the Great War raged on overseas, the tourist business in the Southwest continued to thrive. The Pfaffels' Oñate Hotel was filled to capacity, and Roy took a succession of expeditions into Indian country throughout the summer. In late August, Alice went with him on horseback to the Hopi Snake Dance at Walpi. The conflict in Europe was a vague and distant concern for people on the reservations, although the war had brought a noticeable surplus of cash to Indian country. The U.S. government needed wool for uniforms and blankets, and by late 1917, Navajo sheepherders had more money in their pockets than ever before. However, the Navajos and Hopis were losing their loved ones in a war with another sort of enemy. In the years since Carol and Roy had crossed Navajo and Hopi land on their honeymoon trip, a smallpox epidemic had decimated entire Hopi and Navajo families, and their losses and grief hung like a dark cloud over Indian country. On the road across Hopi land, Carol and Roy crossed trails with a Santa Fean named Nathan B. Stern. Stern was a land developer, and in the late summer of 1917, he was coincidentally the manager of Roy Chapin's Ramon Vigil Ranch on the Pajarito. During a trailside conversation under the hot sun of the high desert, the Pfaffels learned that Stern was on his way to join his regiment in California and was bound for France within a month. Stern needed, actually was legally bound to find, someone to move on to and manage the Pajarito Club. Stern realized that the Pfaffels had precisely the skills and experience needed to manage the remote guest ranch, and then and there he asked Carol and Roy if they would relocate their outfitting business to the Pajarito Plateau and assume the management of the Ramon Vigil Ranch. Carol and Roy were understandably nervous about accepting the position. Their business was doing very well out of the Oñate in Española. The Pajarito Club was a magnificent guest ranch, but it was located in a very remote canyon on the high plateau of the mountains. Roy had worked as a forest ranger in the Jemez Mountains and well knew how the Buckman Road was terrible to dangerous in any season. But how could they say no? Just 1 year ago, Carol and Natalie had prayed for the opportunity to manage and live at the Pajarito Club. The Faffles could hardly pass up the chance to run an outfitting business from the heart of the greatest archaeological region in North America. Stern had to know their decision that day, and before they climbed back into their saddles and rode into their respective horizons, the Faffles and Nat Stern brokered a deal and sealed it with a handshake under the big sky of Hopiland. By early November, Carol and Roy moved to the Pajarito with Mother Gaga and Roy's sister Lois. During their first 2 weeks on the plateau, the Faffles had a full house with 36 guests in the main lodge and cottages of the Pajarito Club. It was an auspicious beginning, and seemed to indicate that neither the war nor the colder weather diminished America's fascination with the ancient, untouched by modern time world of the Pajarito Plateau. The Museum of Art opened with great fanfare and grandiloquence on Saturday evening, November 24, 1917. The old Algodoni spell in the Acoma Tower of the museum announced to Santa Feans and to the several hundred visitors to the city different that the day of celebration had arrived. The dedication exercises would take place over several days, but an enormous crowd of more than 2,000 people came to the opening evening gala. Hewitt, master of ceremonies, spoke briefly, and then the crowd inside St. Francis Auditorium and outside on the road sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and the new art museum's doors were thrown open. Before the first speaker, Dr. David R. Boyd, president of the University of New Mexico, took the podium in the auditorium, the crowded hallways and reception rooms of the museum echoed with an emotionally charged rendition of America, sung by the several thousand visitors filling the halls and courtyard, a moment of spontaneous gratitude for the young men from New Mexico and all over the United States fighting overseas. Alice came to Santa Fe and attended the museum's opening night with the Henrys, the Berlins, and the archaeologists and artists she had met in San Diego when they worked on Hewitt's exhibitions at Balboa Park. Jesse Nussbaum, Ken Chapman, Carlos Vieira, George Bellows, and a dozen others. Hewitt, now director of both New Mexico's Museum of Art and San Diego's Museum of Man, had sent out hundreds of invitations. Roosevelt was personally invited to attend the opening ceremonies, but declined. He wrote Hewitt that he had promised his family he would not travel over the holidays. It was Thanksgiving weekend. Although she missed Natalie's Santa Fe wedding, Alice was very much involved with the San Diego wedding of George DeCliver Curtis to Josephine Laura D. Jones on September 8, 1917. Alice provided the flowers for the bride, who was 27 years old and staying at the Palomar Apartments. Alice may have also arranged the couple's honeymoon lodgings at her friend Miss Chase's bungalow in La Jolla. If Natalie and Paul traveled to San Diego for George and Laura's wedding, George, who was 46 when he married, did not mention it in his diary. In the months before the museum's opening, Henry, anticipating the surge of artists and archaeologists who would come for the celebrations, asked Alice to ship him some liquor because Santa Fe was now a dry town. Alice, daughter of a prominent California merchant, always brought Henry gifts of cigars and cigarettes. But in the fall of 1917, he sent Alice a very specific gift list, and before she left San Diego for New Mexico, she shipped Henry 8 bottles of American gin, 4 bottles of Italian vermouth, and 5 boxes of Melacrino cork-tip cigarettes. Throughout the fall, the Henrys hosted spirited pre-opening dinner parties at their casa at 601 Palace Avenue for the painters and archaeologists working in and around the Palace of the Governors and the new art museum. Henry's association with the new museum brought many nationally recognized painters to Santa Fe. Prominent contemporary artists George Bellows and Leon Kroll came in late summer to tour and paint northern New Mexico, and also to help Henry assemble the art exhibit at the museum. Bellows, a former student of Henry's at the New York School of Art, set up a studio in the old palace. Leon Kroll came to Santa Fe from Colorado Springs to rendezvous with Bellows and Henry and managed to paint several canvases in between the socializing and festivities. Kroll's canvas, Santa Fe Hills, Bellows' Chimayo, and several of Henry's, painted during the summer and fall of 1917, were included in the Art Museum's opening exhibition. Alice had at least one painting in the opening exhibit, whose roster of artists was a virtual who's who in American art. Henry Bellink, Donald Beauregard, George Bellows, Oscar E. Berninghaus, Ernest L. Blumenschein, Paul Berlin, Kenneth Chapman, Edgar S. Cameron, Gerald Cassidy, E. Irving Kaus, Catherine Dudley, W. Herbert Dunton, William Penhallow Henderson, E. Martin Hennings, Robert Henry, Victor Higgins, Alice Klauber, Leon Kroll, Ralph Myers, Arthur F. Musgrave, Sheldon Parsons, Bert G. Phillips, Grave Ravelin, Julius Rolshoven, Doris Rosenthal, Joseph H. Sharp, Walter Ufer, Carlos Vieira, and Theodore Van Solen. After the show, many of the artists donated their paintings to the Art Museum, thus beginning the museum's superb collection of 20th century art. Henry's letters to colleagues back east left no doubt as to his passion and enthusiasm for the new museum and the emerging art colony of Santa Fe. "Santa Fe may do the rare thing and become itself," he wrote to the painter and new San Diego resident Henry Lovins. "The painters are all happy. The climate seems to suit well both temperaments, to work or not to work. And here painters are treated with that welcome and appreciation that is supposed to exist only in certain places in Europe. Being of the to-work temperament myself, I am having a fine time." Walter Pock did not leave his desk in New York City and travel to Santa Fe to review and critique the 300 canvases by 40 contemporary artists, nearly all of whom were well known to him. Pock may have passed up the opportunity to chronicle the opening of a major art museum in the American West, still a frontier on the maps of most New Yorkers, and probably peeved a few of his art world colleagues like Henry and Bellows, but the editors of the New Mexican did their best to make up for the lack of national press coverage. The newspaper's columnists effusively expressed the local sentiment that Santa Fe's museum was worthy of national, if not international, attention, and that the opening exhibition ranks with the Carnegie Gallery in Pittsburgh, the Chicago Art Institute, the Corcoran Art Gallery in Washington, and others. Although the Museum of Art in Santa Fe invited such comparison, the editor added, it was so artistically and architecturally unique, so completely in a class by itself, as to be an institution without parallel in the country. Natalie spoke to a full house in St. Francis Auditorium, which seated more than 600, on Tuesday morning, November 27th. She gave a lecture about Indian music and ceremonial dance and introduced San Ildefonso Pueblo dancers who performed the Eagle Dance on the auditorium stage. A photograph of Natalie Curtis Berlin, taken at that time, captured the confident 42-year-old newlywed astride her horse on the street near the new museum, dressed in formal riding clothes, laced boots, and a broad-brimmed hat, but no khaki. Natalie, like her hometown of Santa Fe, seemed to have done the rare thing and become herself. The photograph became Natalie's 1917 Christmas card and was mailed to friends and family on both coasts. The copy she sent to Lummis was inscribed, "To Mr. Lummis, Sage of the Southwest, the thought of whom dwells in the new museum at Santa Fe and in the hearts of many friends." 14. A Country of Things in Light. I found out that the sunshine in New Mexico could do almost anything with one, make one well if one felt ill, or change a dark mood and lighten it. It entered into one's deepest places and melted the thick, slow densities. It made one feel good. That is, alive. Mabel Dodge Lujan. On a bright afternoon in mid-December 1917, Natalie and Paul Berlin were visited by the New York socialite, Mabel Dodge Stern, who had come to Santa Fe by train the night before. She came with her husband, the painter Maurice Stern, who was a friend of Paul Berlin's from New York City. Stern was also a former student of Robert Henry's, and he had arrived in New Mexico in October and set up a studio in a small adobe just across the road from the Berlins' home at the corner of Buena Vista and Old Santa Fe Trail. When Mabel and Maurice walked into the Berlins' front room, Alice Corbin was on the Taos daybed, knitting a khaki sweater for the Red Cross. Alice Corbin and Natalie warmly greeted Mabel Stern, but their welcome fell on deaf ears. Mabel had been in the capital less than 24 hours, and in spite of her husband's best efforts, had already decided she disliked the little city. Santa Fe was the strangest American town I had ever seen. In that bright December sunshine, the plaza was a queer mixture of oddities. There were wood carts drawn by burros, with the short lengths of piñon wood made into square piles and set in sort of high cages, and these were led by dark Mexicans. I saw only two or three automobiles. People rode horseback or drove two-seated buggies. The only Americans I saw who looked like people I was accustomed to were the shopkeepers in the few stores I went into. Mabel especially loathed the obligatory social call to her husband's friends, the Berlins, whom he praised as pioneers. For 2 months, Maurice Stern had been enjoying the people and environment of Santa Fe and had encouraged his wife to join him in New Mexico and begin a new life in the town at the foot of the Sangre de Cristos. But Santa Fe's expat community did not resonate with the 38-year-old Mabel. Going across to tea at the Berlins was the first really tiresome thing that happened, Dodge wrote of her first day in New Mexico. There was a good deal of bright paint about, yellow and blue, and Paul Berlin's modernist paintings here and there on the walls. Natalie Curtis, his wife, was a little old doll that had been left out in the sun and the rain. She had faded yellow hair, cut in a Buster Brown bob, and faded blue eyes. Paul was much younger and looked fresher. He had curly red hair above a round forehead, and the absent, speculative, thoughtful look of an intelligent Jew. Mabel, who had yet to experience firsthand the effects of New Mexico's high-altitude sun and year-round aridity on the skin, hair, health, and overall disposition of those who lived in the Southwest, was stiff-necked, ill-humored, and unsmiling throughout the visit. She was aggravated and bored by the tea-time talk of Modern Writers and Poetry magazine. Alice and her co-editors, Harriet Monroe and Carl Sandburg, had recently produced a special issue of poetry devoted to Indian chant and song and its influence on modern American poetry. The wartime efforts of the Santa Fe Red Cross and the Berlins and Henderson's plans to spend Christmas Eve and Day at Santo Domingo Pueblo. Before Mabel and Maurice Stern departed the Berlins, Alice Corbin suggested they come tomorrow for tea at the Henderson's home, just a few steps away on the Camino del Monte Sol. Mabel did not respond to the invitation, but instead announced, to her husband's surprise, that she planned to motor up to a place called Taos the next day. And so she did. Thus began Mabel Dodge Stern's, later Mabel Dodge Lujan, very high-profile and famous life in Taos, New Mexico. In spite of her unfriendly behavior and comments, Mabel Dodge Stern knew there was a good deal more to Natalie Curtis Berlin than faded hair and dry skin. Mabel was enormously interested in primitive cultures and was certainly aware of Natalie's extensive travels into and writings about Indian America. Mabel's home at 23 Fifth Avenue in Greenwich Village was only a few blocks from Natalie's family home on Washington Place. They may have not met face-to-face until that December day in Santa Fe, but Mabel and Natalie surely knew something of each other's activities. Mabel also had a home in the town of Croton-on-Hudson, New York, just a few miles from Winfred Douglas's home at St. Mary's in Peekskill. Douglas certainly spoke of Natalie's book and adventures in the Southwest to Mabel, as he was at least partially responsible for Mabel's interest in and inaugural journey to New Mexico. Years later, she mentioned Douglas when she described her first trip to the little-known neighborhood of the Southwest. I armed myself with letters of introduction to several individuals who stood out in that unknown and unexplored land. Among them, one was to Ford Harvey, relative of Fred Harvey, and another to Lorenzo Hubbell. These letters were both given me, after some effort to find people who had been to New Mexico, by a priest named Father Douglas, who had lived near a tribe named Hopi. He had told me strange, wonderful stories about those people. Mabel later claimed that she went so quickly to Taos because Santa Fe was too tame and conventional. But Santa Fe in 1917 could hardly be accused of either of these characteristics. For Mabel, the real problem with Santa Fe was its population, however small, of erudite, creative, and audacious new women who were already making their mark on the place. Mabel needed her own space to make her mark, and the day after the insufferable tea party at the Berlins, Mabel Dodge Stern motored up to Taos with her soon-to-be ex-husband, Maurice, and her son, John Evans, and began her own new life. The Berlins' home on the hill, at the corner of a narrow, dusty lane called Buena Vista, and the rutted dirt road that would later be formally named Old Santa Fe Trail, was in the beating heart of the Santa Fe art colony that flourished almost overnight after the Great War ended in November 1918. Within a stone's throw of Natalie and Paul's front door lived the British painter Arthur F. Musgrave, who, like Alice Corbin, had come in 1916 for a stay at Sunmount, recovered his health, and settled into life in Santa Fe. The painter Louise Crow lived next door to the Berlins, and Sheldon Parsons, the Hendersons, Will Schuster, and Carlos and Ada Vieira all made their homes in adobe houses close by. Morrison Hartley came for a stay at Mabel's new Taos salon in the spring of 1918. Paul Berlin knew Hartley in New York, and he went with Mabel to meet Hartley's train at the Lammy station on June 10th. Alice Klauber's friend and Gertrude's brother, Leo Stein, had recently begun his own infatuation with New Mexico. No longer on speaking terms with his famous sister, Leo was living full-time in New York City. After his pal Mabel moved to New Mexico, it was Leo who encouraged Hartley to go out west and visit her utopian world in Taos. Stein joined Hartley at Mabel's that summer and loved everything about Taos. But Hartley tired of the town and their hostess, and in late summer moved down to Santa Fe and into the casita next to the Berlins in the vibrant Buena Vista neighborhood of artists, writers, and musicians. With Natalie and Paul Berlin, Hartley toured the pueblos of the Rio Grande and met Natalie's many native friends. Hartley was a member of Alfred Stieglitz's Soil and Spirit group of artists, who believed that the spiritual essence of the new American modernism would be found in the American soil. Natalie's long-held belief that Indian music, song, and ritual were a pure and original American art form paralleled Hartley's philosophy of an essential reality found in the landscape and people of the Southwest. With Natalie and her husband as sympathetic and educated guides, Hartley traveled into the remote Indian and Spanish-American country of northern New Mexico. Hartley stayed only 2 years in Santa Fe, but the landscape, like the indigenous people, forever changed him as an artist and a person. "New Mexico is essentially a major sensation for my eye, at least," he wrote. "The sense of form in New Mexico is, for me, one of the profoundest, most original, and most beautiful I have personally experienced. It must be learned. It is not a country of light on things. It is a country of things in light." Santa Fe was as welcoming to the women artists, writers, and archaeologists, although there were few female archaeologists before 1920, as it was to the men who flocked there during and after the war. The author and playwright Mary Hunter Austin arrived in Santa Fe in early November 1918. Austin was in town to investigate land laws and customs of the Native Americans and Hispanic Americans of New Mexico, and Natalie and Alice Corbin were among her first consultants. Within a few weeks of her arrival, however, Austin's socio-political energies were rechanneled into more civic, artistic endeavors when she offered to help Santa Fe establish a community theater like the one she had begun in Carmel, California. With Austin's assistance and direction, the same artists, writers, and archaeologists, whose skills and energies built the new art museum, created the first Santa Fe Community Theater. The opening season featured productions written and produced by locals, including the crowd-pleasing one-act spoof entitled Tranquilina, an Archaeological Absurdity in One Fragment, Discovered, Excavated, and Decoded by Waldo C. Twitchell. The boundaries between the New Mexico art and archaeology communities had always been blurred, and by 1918, on and off stage, the merging of Santa Fe's scientific and artistic colonies was a fait accompli. That same year, Austin wrote the introduction for The Path on the Rainbow, an anthology of Indian songs and chants. Contributors included Natalie, Alice Corbin, Matilda Cox Stevenson, John Peabody Harrington, and J. Walter Fuchs. Austin's introduction noted the instinctive movement of the American people is for a deeper footing in their native soil, and praised Natalie, Alice Fletcher, Frank Cushing, and Washington Matthews for the clarity and sincerity of their literal translations of Indian poetry, music, and dance. I know of no task so salutary to the poet who would, first of all, put himself in touch with a resident genius of his own land. The art and anthropology communities merged in the husband and wife team of Natalie and Paul Berlin when they created a dance drama called The Deer Dance. Natalie wrote the musical score based on adaptations of San Ildefonso Pueblo Deer, Buffalo and Eagle Dance ceremonials, and Paul designed the sets and the costumes. Although it was performed locally, the Berlins' dream to bring the production to New York and Boston never materialized. Although the Pajarito Plateau was less than 30 miles from Santa Fe, the newly renamed guest ranch, the Rancho Ramon Vigil, where Carol and Roy now lived, was so removed from the modern world as to be in another country. The winter of 1918 was warm with almost no measurable snowfall, and the road from Pajarito Canyon to Buckman, where Carol retrieved mail, supplies, and arriving guests, of which there were several dozen, remained dry and passable. But even dry, the journey to and from the ranch was hazardous for horses, wagons, or automobiles. And even with a bridge over the Rio Grande at the Buckman Depot, there was no guarantee that a vehicle or horse could cross the river. The Buckman Bridge was famous for disappearing. If the river was high, the bridge was often washed out, carried downstream by the waters of the Rio Grande. Without the bridge, the only way a vehicle or wagon could cross the river was on the open trestle of the D&RG Railroad. To access the trestle bridge, the driver of a car would back up so as to align the tires with the railroad track and bump its way across the ties with the river swirling ominously below. Even when the Buckman Bridge was intact and above water, it was an unstable, worrisome structure, especially for first-time visitors to the Pajarito. Once across the Rio Grande, the road to Carol and Roy's guest ranch cut up the very steep and very high mesa on the other side. For the Faffles guests, just getting to the Rancho Ramon Vigil was a test of nerves. The original road went in from Buckman, across wobbly old Buckman Bridge, then slantwise in what looked deceptively like one straight gash up the formidable escarpment of the Pajarito Plateau, in a 2-mile stretch of ruts and rock, called Buckman Hill. In spite of the challenges involved with reaching the guest ranch, throughout the winter and spring of 1918, the 5 guest rooms in the 2-story main house and the 13 rooms in the 8 cabins were filled with lodgers who paid $21 a week for the privilege of a bed and meals on the remote plateau. Many of these folks were friends or friends of friends. Charles Lummis was among Carol's first guests and came twice in December 1917, his second visit coinciding with Carol and Roy's birthday party on December 16th. Mother Gaga's birthday was on December 17th, so Carol and Roy's birthday cake included candles for Gaga, and there was plenty of sparkling burgundy for Lummis and the ranch guests. In January, Hewitt's friend and a patron of the new art museum, Frank Springer, came for several days, and Natalie and Carol's attorney and business advocate, Elbridge Adams, made his way up the plateau with several Rothschilds and one of the Rockefellers. With Roy and Carol as guides, the Adams entourage spent the week touring Frijoles Canyon and other archaeological sites on the Pajarito. Natalie's horse, Buck, was stabled with Carol and Roy's horses on the plateau, and the Berlins and the Hendersons came to the plateau for horse excursions and overnights. Charles Lummis returned in March during Easter and went Benitenti hunting with Carol and Roy and a crowd of unnamed friends that may have included the Hendersons and the Berlins. Except for expected and routine car and truck troubles, overheated engines, blowouts, punctured tires, and burst radiators, it was an uneventful winter. Gaga and a friend did get stranded in their car on Buckman Hill one afternoon and had to walk home, and several guests became temporarily lost while hiking about the canyons. But Roy and Carol managed to find everyone and return them safely to ranch headquarters before dark. In April and May, a Boston acquaintance of Carol's and Natalie's from the South End Music Settlement School in Boston, Mary Cabot Wheelwright, came with a friend to stay at the ranch on the Pajarito. Carol's personal staff now included Alice Pring, an Englishwoman who joined the household that winter as Carol's maid. Gaga, Carol, and Alice worked dawn to dusk on laundry, dishes, meals, and guest entertainment and transportation needs. Gaga's diary records that a young man from Denver named Eric worked as Roy's ranch hand throughout that winter and spring. The diary does not reveal the man's full name, but he may be Eric, Canon Douglas's son. As managers of a guest ranch, Roy and Carol's daily routine was a relentless repetition of mundane but necessary chores. Carol fled the plateau for overnights in Santa Fe with Natalie, and for 10 days in February, she went alone to Denver to stay with the Douglases in Evergreen. The lack of snow and the January heat wave, Gaga recorded the temperature on the house porch at 90 degrees on January 2nd, meant a very dry spring. Roy, having worked as a forest ranger in this country, well understood the implications of a snowless winter. The streams of the Pajarito Canyons would be low flow at best, bone dry at worst, and with drought came the threat of forest fires. Throughout the winter and spring, Carol kept Roy Chapin and his partners, who were looking for a buyer for the Rancho Ramon Vigil, apprised of the ranch's activities. Chapin was living in Washington, D.C., serving on the War Department's Highways Transportation Committee. Henry Joy was a captain with the U.S. Signal Corps and was also living in D.C. The Gray brothers remained in Detroit. Carol hated bothering Chapin with trivial issues, but when the drought lowered the water table on the plateau and the ranch wells began to run dry, she was forced to share the dire news with him. "We are, frankly, terribly nervous about the water," Carol wrote Chapin after she returned to the Pajarito from Denver in late February. "All there is in the whole canyon is a tiny bit in the well near the tennis court. We serve on the table and for bathing weird dark brown fluid which naturally scares most of our guests and has lost us some. Boiling fails to improve its color, and our immaculate Mother Faffel has been reduced almost to tears because one newcomer asked her if her pitcher might be cleaned occasionally." It seemed like divine intervention when, in late February 1918, Roy was asked to accompany a wealthy Denver mining magnate, James R. Thorpe, on a property tour in the Tusuki Hills near Santa Fe, where Thorpe wanted to build an upscale resort. Thorpe liked what he saw, and on April 18, 1918, bought 152.8 acres of land from the family of William Scoville and Edith Pulitzer Moore. This property in the Piñon Juniper foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, 4 miles from the plaza of Santa Fe, named Bishop's Ranch, included the chapel and retreat once used by the French Jesuit Archbishop Jean-Baptiste Lamy. It was a spectacular location for a guest ranch. Unlike the rustic and isolated Rancho Ramon Vigil, Bishop's Ranch had the luxuries of electric lights and heating systems, indoor plumbing, landscaped gardens, orchards, and water. The estate had 2 lakes on the property. Before Thorpe even placed an offer on the Tusuki property, he asked the Faffels if they would like to oversee the creation and management of his new Bishop's Ranch, soon renamed Bishop's Lodge. Carol immediately wrote Chapin that she and Roy were considering Thorpe's offer. They still owned the small outfitting business in Española, and Carol told Chapin that Roy thought they could feasibly run a circuit business and manage all 3 operations. The Rancho Ramon Vigil became an untenable situation even for the resolute Faffels when the plateau wells went dry in early March. "Our sword of Damocles has fallen," Carol wrote Chapin. "The well has gone dry, and now, with a house full of people, we are hauling water from nearby canyons." An Española sheep rancher and businessman, Frank Bond, and his brothers purchased the Ramon Vigil from Chapin and Company by late April, and Carol, Roy, Gaga, Roy's sister Lois, and most of the Faffels' employees moved down to the new Bishop's Ranch by May. In the spring of 1918, while talking to a local bear hunter and outfitter named C.B. Ruggles in front of the Capitol Pharmacy near the Santa Fe Plaza, Roy was introduced to a young cowboy named Jack Lambert. Ruggles knew Roy and Carol were setting up the new Bishop's Ranch and suggested Roy consider Lambert as a ranch hand. When Roy learned Lambert was a seasoned cowboy and outdoorsman, he invited the Santa Fe newcomer to join him for lunch at a local diner. Everett Vey Jack Lambert was all of 20 when he met Roy Pfaffel in Santa Fe. Born in Okarchi, Oklahoma, in 1898, Lambert had spent several years living on his horse. As a teenager, he worked as a cowpuncher, pack guide, camp cook, taxi driver, even a bridge builder on the Green River, as he made his way across the desert and mountains of the Southwest. The ruggedly handsome Lambert was tall and thin, even-tempered, courteous and thoughtful. When in the company of ladies, he was a perfect gentleman, and he was as comfortable on a horse in the deep outback as he was in a corral filled with high-maintenance, wide-eyed dudes just off the train from the east. Jack Lambert, like Roy Pfaffel, was a self-educated, self-made, self-reliant man, born and raised in the hardscrabble country of the Great Plains. Roy and Jack liked each other immediately, and over lunch at the diner near the plaza, Roy offered Lambert a job at the new Bishop's Ranch. Lambert accepted, and thus began a 12-year partnership between Lambert and Roy and the extended Pfaffel family. Roy and Jack were still pulling boards off the windows and renovating guest cabins when the first guests arrived at Bishop's Ranch. Carol oversaw the daily management of the ranch, while Roy and Lambert organized and packed up expeditions, often from Roy's livery stable in Española, and headed out into the Four Corners Indian country. Bishop's Ranch guests went on auto and horse trips to Chaco Canyon, Canyon de Chelly, the natural bridges of Utah, and through the Mesa Verde region. That first year, Roy led at least two groups on epic pack trips to Kayenta and the Rainbow Bridge between May and August. Charles Lummis came to see Bishop's Ranch in July, and with Carol and Roy and their overland touring car, went up to the Pajarito. The Pfaffels continued to maintain the lodge at the Rancho Ramon Vigil for the Bond brothers, and with Lummis, they hiked Frijoles Canyon during the day and stayed nights at the former Pajarito Club. Roy Chapin came with his wife and three-year-old son, Roy Jr., in October for a two-week retreat at Bishop's Ranch. Carol had become friends with Chapin's wife, Inez, during her trip to Detroit, and the Pfaffels accompanied the Chapin family on an auto tour of northern New Mexico that included an overnight at the Pajarito Club. The rumors of an armistice dominated conversations that October, and during dinners with guests and family at the Bishop's Ranch, Chapin shared an insider's view of the war and also read aloud from some very interesting speeches brought from his office in Washington. Mr. Hubble, either Don Lorenzo or one of his sons, Gaga's diary entry does not specify, came from Ganado to visit the Pfaffels at the new Bishop's Ranch several times that fall and winter. Hubble's first visit coincided with Carol and Roy's anniversary party, and Hubble joined the Chapins and the other Bishop's Ranch guests in dining and dancing with the Pfaffels and the ranch staff late into the night. Hubble returned again before Christmas and was a guest at Carol and Roy's birthday party on December 16th. Roy's anniversary present to Carol that year was a grand piano, the first piano she had had in New Mexico, which was placed in the Bishop's Ranch main house. Carol played an informal concert on October 16th for the guests, who included Judge and Mrs. Abbott, who had a ranch in Frijoles Canyon, the Chapins, who were departing for the east in the morning, and Hubble. A perfectly sublime fall evening of music and friends came to a sudden end when Carol fainted. Although Gaga commented in her diary that we had a time bringing her to, she provided no further details about Carol's collapse. Carol fainted several more times in the next weeks and was bedridden with influenza after Christmas. Now that Carol had a piano in the house, she offered music lessons to neighbor children and friends. She also gave her teenage sister-in-law, Lois, voice and piano lessons. Lois, however, was an unenthusiastic student and preferred horse or auto excursions in the mountains to afternoons inside the lodge at a piano with her older brother's wife. Like her mother, Lois resented Carol's executive position in Roy's businesses. Carol kept the books and dictated the house budget, and was critical of her shopping holidays to Denver and Chicago. A good bit of Lois's disgruntlement with her sister-in-law was really a teenager's declaration of independence. Lois frequently left the ranch in Tusuki to horseback ride with friends or go into the movies in Santa Fe. Lois especially liked to do anything in the company of Jack Lambert, who, although only 3 years her senior, was not considered a proper suitor, at least by Gaga, Roy, and even Carol. The Great War came to an end on November 11, 1918. Santa Feans, like folks in towns and cities across America, awoke at dawn to loud whistles that announced the signing of the armistice and the cessation of hostilities. The bells of the Capitol churches and the new museum joined the shrill whistles from City Hall and the Santa Fe Water and Light Company. By mid-morning, there were boisterous demonstrations around the plaza, and every motor car in town was in motion, and every one of them decorated with bunting. Children on wobbling cycles joined the throngs of people who carried the flags of the United States, Italy, and France through downtown Santa Fe, past the Art Museum and around the plaza. And Carol and Roy drove into Santa Fe by midday to confirm the news and to celebrate with friends. The end of the war marked the end of an era in Santa Fe and the American Southwest. The sense of a frontier landscape separated geographically and temperamentally from the rest of the United States and the world would rapidly diminish within the next year, and a great surge of visitors and new residents would make their way to the land of enchantment. In 1920, Natalie received a small inheritance and with it purchased the three-room adobe casita near the corner of East Buena Vista Street and Old Santa Fe Trail that she and Paul had been living in for several years. After adding a small kitchen and purchasing a few handcrafted and locally made benches, chairs, and tables, the Berlins settled very comfortably into married life. The little house and its hand's breadth of land sat on a hill and had fine views to the north and east of the roads to the plaza and of the foothills of the Sangre de Cristos. Although considered modern by New Mexico standards, the house had running water and indoor plumbing, a telephone and electric lights, and its three quaint rooms fashioned with a wand in true Santa Fe style. The Berlin's adobe was not, by a Greenwich Village New Yorker's criteria, much to write home about. Indeed, had Natalie's Washington Place family come to Santa Fe and stepped through the rough wood doorway into her mud-and-timber, dirt-roofed abode, they would have been appalled. Natalie's adobe in Old Santa Fe would not have shocked George, though. Like Natalie, George Curtis had slept in the mud, stone, and wood dwellings that were home to the Southwest's native peoples, and he had lived in rustic cabins and tents in far-flung cow camps. Natalie suggested that George come and stay with her and Paul in Santa Fe, although her only guest room was the breezeway between rooms, in which she and Paul often slept in the summer. But George couldn't get to Santa Fe. He and his wife Laura had their hands full with their ranch. Although Henry did not return to Santa Fe until 1922, he continued to send his friends and colleagues to New Mexico. In the summer of 1919, after listening to several years of Henry's incessant, effusive praise about the light and character of New Mexico, the artist and teacher John Sloan decided to undertake the arduous cross-country auto trip to investigate the situation in Santa Fe. Sloan convinced a friend, Randall Davy, to join him on this adventure, and with their unenthusiastic wives, the two painters drove a 1912 90-horsepower Simplex chain-drive touring car from New York to Santa Fe in 1919. It was a great day for John Sloan when he discovered New Mexico. Walter Pock would later write about Sloan and Company's arrival in Santa Fe. But it was also a great day for New Mexico. By 1919, Sloan was nearly as prominent in American art as Henry. He was one of the Ashcan 8 painters, was a founder and president of the Society of Independent Artists, and had exhibited alongside Henry in the Independent Exhibition in 1910 and the Armory Show in 1913. Sloan was also a close acquaintance of Walter Pock, who had been his student in 1906 when Sloan and Henry were instructors at the New York School of Art. Sloan and Davy liked the light, the landscape, and the people of Santa Fe. They also liked Hewitt's and the Art Museum's open-door exhibition policy, Santa Fe's non-academic creative environment, and the exceptional community of artists who welcomed them with open arms. And once they climbed out of the noisy, cramped, dusty touring car, their wives took a liking to Santa Fe, too. Within a week, Hewitt set Sloan and Davy up in studios at the Palace of the Governors and helped them find comfortable quarters to rent near the plaza. Dolly and John Sloan loved their summer in Santa Fe and became seasonal residents, returning every summer for the next 30 years. But Randall Davey and his wife Isabel liked Santa Fe so much they wanted a permanent place of their own, and in 1920 they bought the historic house and orchard of Candelario Martinez at the top of the Santa Fe Canyon east of town. Alice Klauber had met Randall Davey in the summer of 1912, when the 25-year-old Davey was Henry's affable and capable assistant in Italy. When he arrived in Santa Fe in 1919, Davey was a nationally known and award-winning painter, enjoying much success on the American art scene. He had exhibited in the Armory Show in 1913, and in 1915 won the Julius Hallgarten Prize of the National Academy of Design and honorable mention at Balboa Park's art exhibition. Davey had studied architecture at Cornell, and he personally directed the enlargement and restoration of the structure that had served as Santa Fe's first sawmill in 1847. Located near the entrance to the Santa Fe National Forest on what became Upper Canyon Road, the Davey home became a favorite gathering place for Santa Fe's burgeoning colony of artists, writers, musicians, and archaeologists. Although Davey continued to teach semesters at the Chicago Art Institute, he and his wife and son made Santa Fe their primary residence. Davey became one of Santa Fe's most devoted residents and surely spoke for the Berlins, Hendersons, Pfaffels, and a few dozen other New Mexico expats when he wrote, "I wouldn't trade my life here where I can hunt, shoot, ride, for all that committee going and bootlicking you've got to do in a city for anything. An artist might starve for food here, but he'll starve spiritually in a place like New York." Although Natalie had finally found a devoted partner with whom she could share her love of the land and people of the West, and now had a home and place of her own in the affirming and stimulating environment of Santa Fe, she kept her promise to Frizzell, Peabody, and Mason, and returned to the East and resumed her study of African-American music. In 1918 to 1919, Natalie's complete study was published in four volumes titled Negro Folk Songs. As she had in the Indians book, Natalie included cultural context and background information on the words, tunes, and symbolism of African-American music, music she believed was an essential and vital part of modern America's life and culture. Kurt Schindler added Natalie's arrangements of Negro spirituals to the Schola Cantorum program in New York in July 1918. 18 months later, Frank Damrosch and the Musical Arts Society of New York performed two of Natalie's concert arrangements of African-American Christmas songs in their annual Christmastime program. In 1919, while Natalie was back in New York City working on her books of Negro music, Carroll contacted Winfred Douglass and with his assistance enrolled Roy's sister Lois in the private school run by the Good Sisters at St. Mary's in Peekskill, where Douglass was music director. Although Carroll was friends with the wranglers and cowboys that worked for her, and had herself dramatically eloped with a cowboy just a few years before, she hoped Lois would not marry a cowboy. At least, not for a few years. Everyone around Bishop's Ranch knew that Jack Lambert was sweet on 17-year-old Lois. Only physical separation would avert premature matrimony. Gaga and Carroll did not agree on much, but they agreed that Lois needed to be sent east to finish high school. And by the fall of 1919, Lois Pfaffel was sent to live in Peekskill, under the watchful tutelage of Canon Winfred and Dr. Joe Douglass. Jack Lambert drove Lois to the station at Lammy to catch the train for Chicago. He did not, however, stay to watch Lois depart. "Poor Jack," Lois wrote her mother. "He didn't stay until the train left. He just went down and then left." During her first months in Peekskill, Lois was introduced to the art and culture of New York City by the Douglasses and by Dorothy Kent, who was at home in nearby Tarrytown. Lois stayed with the Douglas family over Christmas and also remained with them for the summer holiday. She became an adept urban traveler and went weekly by train or motor car into New York for lunch, shopping, and evenings at the movies. She went to numerous Carnegie Hall events with the Douglasses and with Dorothy Kent, and was frequently in the audience for Schindler's choral concerts. During her first winter at St. Mary's, Lois met Natalie for the first time at Dorothy's home, where Natalie often came to ice skate on the Kent's Pond. In March 1920, Lois went into New York with Kent and the Douglasses to visit Natalie at her studio. They braved a cold and pouring rain to have tea with Jesse Nussbaum and Frederick Webb Hodge, friends of Natalie's and Douglas's, whom Lois may have already met in New Mexico. Nussbaum lived in Santa Fe and was a frequent camper on the Pajarito Plateau. Hodge had worked at Frijoles Canyon in 1910 alongside Hewitt and Nussbaum, and returned to the Southwest each summer for extended field work. A prominent anthropologist and writer, and the former director of the Bureau of American Ethnology, Hodge edited the massive Handbook of North American Indians. When Lois met him at Natalie's in 1920, Hodge was the director of the New York Museum of the American Indian, and with Nussbaum was working during the summer months on the excavation of Hawiku at Zuni Pueblo in New Mexico. Although Carol and Roy orchestrated Lois's separation from Jack Lambert, within a year of his arrival, Lambert had become indispensable to the Pfaffels and was essentially a full partner in their outfitting business. He had also become Carol and Roy's most trusted friend. As such, in the next decade, Lambert, like Carol, would witness and suffer the personal and professional consequences of Roy Pfaffel's escalating gambling and alcohol addiction. Roy, like most men who came of age as a cowboy or homesteader, learned to play cards at a young age. He was good at poker, but he lost as much as he won, and as his gambling became habitual, so did his drinking. In late 1919, James Thorpe, owner of Bishop's Ranch, fired Roy Pfaffel as his ranch manager, claiming Roy was mismanaging the new guest ranch. In fact, Bishop's Ranch was doing very well at the time. Thorpe may have heard about Roy's poker escapades and hoped that by firing him, he was distancing Bishop's Ranch from the seedier side of northern New Mexico. However, it is also possible that Roy's dismissal was a defensive move by Thorpe, because at that precise time, November 1919, the Pfaffels, in partnership with Lambert, were assembling the funds with which to purchase property in Alcalde, where they planned to build their own guest ranch. The Pfaffels' attorney, Francis O. Wilson of Santa Fe, was negotiating a deal with the family of Elias Clark for several historic and decrepit adobe buildings and 34,000 acres of land bordered by San Juan Pueblo and the eastern bank of the Rio Grande. It was a spectacular location for a guest ranch. Alcalde, a tiny penitente village 4 miles north of Española, was located on the road that connected Santa Fe to Taos through the tectonic chasm called the Rio Grande Gorge, although more than a 30-mile drive over rough roads to Santa Fe. Alcalde was located near the confluence of the Chama and Rio Grande rivers, and the Clark property had unimpeded access to the best horse and auto routes north and west to Colorado and Arizona Indian country. The Sangre de Cristo Mountains dominated the length of the eastern horizon, and the Jimez Mountains and the Pajarito Plateau, a half-day's ride across the lands of 3 Tewa pueblos, San Juan, Santa Clara, and San Ildefonso, rose above the river valley to the south and west. The purchase of the Alcalde property, at least partially underwritten by loans from friends and private investors, was completed by February 1920. With Lambert, the Pfaffels began the colossal task of rebuilding the decrepit dwellings, outbuildings, and corrals. Carol planted flower and vegetable gardens, furnished and decorated the adobe casitas in the style and manner she had admired at Louisa Wetherill's home in Kayenta, and renovated the historic hacienda into a rustic but charming ranch headquarters. Carol and Roy named their guest ranch San Gabriel. The name paid homage to San Gabriel del Yungue, the first Spanish settlement in New Mexico, established 4 miles downriver from the Pfaffels Ranch in 1598. But Carol was also honoring her own migration story. The Episcopalian School of St. Mary's in Peekskill, New York, was built on Mount St. Gabriel, high above the Hudson River. It is possible that during a visit to Winfred Douglas's home at the school on Mount San Gabriel, Carol had begun to imagine her journey to the Wetherills and a new life in the Southwest. By spring, Carol had produced a brochure about San Gabriel Ranch that became part of the Santa Fe Railway's post-war campaign promoting tourism in the Southwest. The ranch letterhead was graced with a simple little bird petroglyph found in abundance in the ancient villages on the Pajarito Plateau. During their 3 years at the Rancho Ramon Vigil and Bishop's Ranch, Carol had assembled a large mailing list, and she sent out announcements of the new guest ranch to former and prospective clients, and to friends in Chicago, Boston, New York, and Southern California. By summer of 1920, the dude ranch called San Gabriel was on the map. San Gabriel's resident staff included the most experienced cowpunchers, dude wranglers, wilderness guides, and automobile drivers and mechanics found in New Mexico. Horse